Mention and discuss the relational relations you find between the sins denounced in chapter 1 and the sins that are denounced in chapter 2. In order to answer this question, would you please compare the first two chapters of Micah with Matthew 22, verses 37 to 40. In Matthew 22, 37 to 40, the Lord Jesus summarized the whole law under two commandments. Listen to Matthew 22, 37 to 40. And Jesus said unto him, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second like unto it is this, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments, the whole law hangeth, what? And the prophets. The whole law hangeth and the prophets. The first commandment, of course, deals with love for God. And the second commandment deals with love for man. Now, Exodus 31, verse 18, says that when God gave the law to Moses, he gave the law to Moses in two tables of stone. And as we studied in the detailed tale in connection with the Pentateuch, I reminded you that on the first table of stone, you have the commandments dealing with love for God. And on the second table of stone, you have the commandments dealing with love for man. Now, this isn't just a little chronological order that's easy to remember, but it's the foundational order. It's impossible to love man if I don't love God. You see, that's the first commandment, and I can never obey the second commandment if I don't obey the first commandment. Now, love for God is always the starting point of love for man. And there's never real love for man apart from real love for God. Now you see the bearing this has on the first two chapters of Micah. Here is chapter 1. Chapter 1 of Micah denounces sins against the first table of the law. More specifically, Micah 1 denounces the sin of idolatry. And idolatry is the wrong relation towards God. Then, chapter 2 begins the great emphasis of Micah. Chapter 2 is the sins against the second table of the law. Now, where does Micah place his chief emphasis? You see, in the prophecy as a whole, Micah places his chief emphasis on sins against the second table of the law in connection with social relationships. And that's why it's so important to realize that although he emphasized that, he doesn't begin there. The starting point is not wrong relationship to man. The starting point is wrong relationship toward God. Let me just give it to you in another diagram in form of what I call foundation and superstructure. The foundation is our wrong relationship to God. And the superstructure is the outworking of that, our wrong relationship to man. Well, of course, ordinarily, we state that in a positive way. Our right relationship to God resulting in our right relationship to man. But you see, the reason why I state it negatively here is because Micah states it negatively. Micah says wrong relationship to God always results in wrong relationship to man. Some time ago I heard a minister make this statement. He said, we need the faith of the fundamentalist and the love of the modernist. What about that? We need the faith of the fundamentalist and the love of the modernist. Now that statement sounds good to some people, but that's a modernistic statement in itself. You see why it's modernistic? Because can the modernist really love? Of course not. Nobody can love if he doesn't believe in the blood of Jesus. And you see, the whole fallacy of the so-called social gospel is this, that you can have the right relationship to man without having the right relationship to God. Micah is just the opposite of the so-called social gospel. That's why I lay great stress upon these first two chapters. Chapter 1 is sins against the first table of the law, lack of love for God. And then chapter 2 is and table of the law and its wrong relationship towards our fellow man. If I'm wrong towards God, then I'm wrong everywhere. If you're wrong towards God, then you're wrong everywhere. Look at chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Micah is prophesying now the invasion of the Assyrian army. And when he prophesies in chapter 1, the invasion of the Assyrian army, he plays on the meaning of these names of the towns that are going to be invaded and are going to be destroyed. For this will I lament and wail. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the jackals and a lamentation like unto the ostriches. For her wounds are incurable, for it is come even unto Judah. You see, Assyrians invaded Israel. But it comes even unto Judah, it reaches unto the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. Now, one reason I emphasize this passage is, it shows that Micah entered into the sufferings of those who were suffering because of God's judgment. Micah entered into the sufferings of those who were suffering because of God's judgment. Oh, how important that is. Are we to pray for God's judgment upon those who reject the Lord? Yeah, that's one side of it. No, here's the other side. That we are to enter into the sufferings of those who are suffering because of God's judgment. This just never illustrates the fact that the prophets of God were not disinterested onlookers. They were not only not disinterested onlookers, they were not even interested onlookers. But they were right in the midst of the suffering. One indication of it here is this 8th verse where he says, I will lament and wail, I will go stripped and naked. Another indication of it is the little town that he mentioned along with the others. Did you notice that? One town that he mentioned as being destroyed by the invaders is more than a gap. Well, you see, the first verse of Micah says that Micah was the Moorish type. And that title, Moreshite, means that he came from the village of Moreshite. And you see, when he's talking about all these towns that are going to be invaded and destroyed, he includes his hometown. And he's letting folks know he's not just a disinterested onlooker. You ever ask yourself this question? Sometimes I wonder if Micah's own home was torn down by the Assyrians who invaded. I don't know. But you see, Micah himself suffered because of the doctrine of self-rule. And one reason he hated self-rule and loved Christ-rule is that he suffered because of it himself. That's one way God's going to drive home into your life the truth of Christ-rule instead of self-rule. He's going to let you suffer from self-rule, just as Micah suffered from self-rule. Not only with your own self-rule, but self-rule in the lives of others. Self-rule in the lives of others can bring great suffering to a Christian whose life is characterized by Christ's rule. And it's one way God turns you and me away from self-rule. He lets us suffer from those who are ruling their own lives. In verses 8 to 16, as I told you, Micah mentioned several towns, and all of these are just neighboring towns to Moreshet-Gath. It just sounds right around where he's been brought up all his life, and probably he's visiting all those times. And you see how close home this comes to him. It's just like somebody today who lives in Roanoke, and he says, Roanoke's going to be destroyed. And not only will Roanoke be destroyed, but Rocky Mount will be destroyed, and Booth Mill will be destroyed, and Martinsville will be destroyed, and Lexington will be destroyed, and Buchanan will be destroyed. You see, he bands out into the vicinity. All this thing comes close home. And in doing it, he plays on the meaning of the names of these particular towns. If there's time and again, as you study the prophets, you'll find evidences that the prophets knew the meaning of Romans 12:15. Of course, Romans 12:15 was not yet in the Bible, but the truth of God was still there. You know what Romans 12:15 says? Rejoice with them that do rejoice and weep with them that weep. Oh, how important that is in the Christian life. And you see, that's the element of truth in this whole thing of psychiatrical counseling and that sort of thing. That you've got to understand everything about a person if you're going to lead him into victory. Oh, no, that's nonsense. But here's the element of truth in it that's not nonsense. The element of truth is, rejoice with those that do rejoice. Weep for those that weep. And you see, if I obey God on that, then I'm going to have what people call an understanding heart. I'm not going to be sullen to be around all the time. And if people are happy and rejoicing something that's good and legitimate, well, I'm going to be happy with them. I rejoice with those that do rejoice. And then when people are suffering, even when they're suffering as the judgment of God, I won't stand off and just look at them in a distance, but I'll enter with them into their suffering. Micah knew Christ in the fellowship of his suffering. And because he knew Christ in the fellowship of his suffering, he knew Israel in the fellowship of Israel's suffering. And that's one of the main points I missed for years when I studied this first chapter. I got so involved in the meaning of the towns and everything, I missed the main point. So to summarize it, this passage shows that Micah entered into the sufferings of those who were suffering because of God's judgment. You'll notice the 8th verse uses the word naked. And that naturally would bring up a question to your mind. I will go stripped to naked. Does that mean that the prophet appeared in public without any clothes on? Very clearly it does not mean that. You see, any word can be used in an absolute sense or in a relative sense. And that word naked sometimes in the Bible is used in the absolute sense as we ordinarily use it. All the clothes are loose in the body. Many times it's used in the relative sense. And probably what it means here is, you see, the Oriental in a special way wore a tight-fitting undergarment and then a loose-flowing outer garment, especially with that true of the prophet. The prophet, when he appeared in public, ordinarily wore this loose-flowing garment called the prophet's garb. And anyway, that's what the passage means. He's going to go stripped and naked. That is, when he appears in public and people see him and he preaches to people, he doesn't wear that prophet's robe. And that would automatically arrest attention. And people come to him and say, Micah, why don't you wear the prophet's robe? And he'd say, I'm naked. Just like you're going to be naked when the Assyrians invade, when the judgment is going to come. This passage might be compared with John 21, verse 7 in the New Testament. You remember John 21, 7 says that Peter found out it was Jesus, and he swam to him. He was naked. And that expression, naked, evidently doesn't mean no clothes on his body, but it evidently means the loose-flowing outer garment was not on his body. On page 83, that is the meaning of chapter 1, verse 13. Bind the chariot to the swift steed, O inhabitant of Lachish. What he means is, make haste to escape. Put your chariot along with a very swift horse. You get ready to escape in a hurry, because the Assyrians are going to invade. She was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for the transgressions of Israel were found in thee. I told you the first chapter especially denounces sin against the first table of the law. Well, for God, this is idolatry. Over the word lavish, will you write the word horse pound? Make a hyphenated word out of it. That's what lavish means, horse pound. And it was called horse pound because horses of the sun were kept there. They called them horses of the sun because these were used in connection with the idolatry of Baal worship. You know, Baal was the god of nature, especially the sun god. And they kept the horses connected with Baal worship there. And Lachish is called the beginning of sin because it was a border city right on the border of Judah, touching Israel. And so it was here that the idolatry of the northern kingdom was first introduced into the southern kingdom. And because the idolatry of the northern kingdom was first introduced to the southern kingdom, it said it was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. Well, you know, there are many parallels to that. I hate to have a part in anybody's iniquity. But especially do I hate to have a part in being the beginning of sin. To let these false influences begin in my life and ministry. And you know, it's a very frightening thing that just constantly drives me back to the new covenant. And that is that in my dealings with you young people, I can be the beginning of sin. I can be the beginning of false tendencies in your life. That's what this passage is talking about. Linkage with the border town where the horses connected with idolatrous worship were kept. And so it was called the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. Notice, the beginning of sin is not this, lack of love for man. The beginning of sin is this, lack of love for God. And that's where idolatry comes in. You can't believe wrong and live right. That's a great teaching of the Bible. And it's a great teaching of chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Micah. You see, this Assyrian invasion is described in great detail, but it's all in connection with idolatry, chapter 1. Then chapter 2, he goes into these social sins. But he doesn't start with the social sins. He starts with the sins against the first table of the law. Is that right? I think he's wrong there. The idea of the beginning of sin, whether it was on the border or not, it was certainly located in a strategic place so that the whether it was literally on the border, my information is it was literally on the border, but whether it was or not, it was the beginning of sin. That is that idolatry that spread from the 10 northern tribes down into Judah began at Lachish. And that's one reason why God judged them. At least it's figuratively true, it was on the border. Iniquity and work evil upon their bed. Now, the first passage in Micah concerning social sins is in this chapter. He doesn't touch on these social sins in the first chapter. It's first idolatry, sins against God directly. Then he comes to the social sins. And someone has given this title to chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, the Jerusalem men of wealth. And here, of course, you have a great denunciation of rich people and the way in which they mistreat the poor. Will them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds? The idea is that they lie awake at night devising schemes by which they may defraud the people. And then they can hardly wait for morning to come to put these schemes into action. When the morning is light, they practice it because it's in the power of their hands. And they covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. And they oppress a man in his house, even a man in his heritage. Therefore, thus saith Jehovah, behold, against this family do I devise an evil from which he shall not remove your neck, neither shall you walk haughtily, for it is an evil sign. You notice that as this passage unfolds, the sin of covetousness becomes greater all the time. He starts off and he mentions covetousness in its beginning, and then the covetousness just gets worse and worse. To me, it's a great illustration of what we call the stranglehold of covetousness. If I don't let God deal with covetousness basically in my life, well, there are no limits to which I can't go. If you don't let God deal with covetousness in your life, then there are no limits to which you can't go. In order to drive home the thought here, I'd like for you in your notes to draw a circle around the word devise in the first sentence. And then in the next to the last line, draw another circle around the word devise and connect them with a straight line. Woe unto them that devise iniquity. And then God says, against this family, behold, I do devise an evil. Now, this is very common in the prophets, to repeat a key word to describe God's response to man's sin. And God is saying, if you devise, then I'll devise against you. You see, it's the law of retribution. And this is very common in the prophets. Here's what Micah is saying. In the opening part of the passage, man devises iniquity. But he comes back and says, God devises calamity. See, one thing is said over against another. Wherever man devises iniquity, God will devise calamity. In other words, God is saying, if you devise against others, then I'll devise against you. You know, it's a mighty strong thing to have God scheme against you. But that's what he's saying here. If you scheme against others to put something across, then I'll scheme against you. And young people, don't you think this is beyond your reach? Scheming in the energy of the flesh. Of course, a great illustration of that is Jacob in the Old Testament. Scheming in the energy of the flesh. And you say, yeah, Esau almost got him. No, it wasn't Esau who almost got him. It was God who got him. Because Jacob schemed against Esau and God schemed against Jacob. It isn't wrong for God to scheme in the way in which he does it. He can do it in a holy way. But God's saying, if you devise, then I'll devise. If you devise iniquity, then I will devise calamity. On page 84, we come to our first great messianic prophecy in Micah. Told you last time that there are four great messianic passages in the book of Micah. And here's the first one, chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. The significant thing is that for just two verses, the Holy Spirit breaks through the gloom of sin and judgment. These first three chapters are just filled with sin and judgment, deep gloom. But just for two verses, the Holy Spirit breaks through the gloom. And then he goes right back to the sin and gloom. In a moment, I'll try to show you the reason for that. I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, as they flock in the midst of their pasture. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. The breaker has gone up before them. They have broken forth and passed on to the gate and are gone out thereat. And their king is passed on before them, and Jehovah at the head of them. Now, as I told you, this is the first of the four great messianic passages in Micah. And it can be summarized in these words. The blessed result of Christ's rule. The blessed result of Christ's rule. Do you think why he seems to change the subject? You see, the whole purpose here is to turn us away from self-rule to Christ-rule. And what's the main emphasis he has in the first three chapters? To turn us away from self-rule to Christ-rule. The main emphasis is to show the awful results of self-rule. Well, you see, at the beginning of chapter 3, you're going to come back to the terrible picture of a cannibal feast, acting like cannibals. And you see, the purpose of this is just to show how awful self-rule is. It makes you act like a bunch of cannibals. Now, if I rule my life, you can just expect me to act like a bunch of cannibals. I may do it in a refined sort of way, but I'll still do it. And if you rule your own life, that's what I can expect. You just act like a bunch of cannibals. You'll do it in a refined way, perhaps, or an unrefined way, perhaps, but you'll still do it. And you see, that's the great thrust of these first three chapters, to show the awful results of self-rule. But right in the middle, he just inserts this passage. It seems like he's changing the subject as he breaks away from the gloom of sin and darkness. But no, he's not changing the subject. He's giving the precious, blessed result of Christ's rule. All right, now tell me from this passage, what is the blessed result of Christ's rule? If Christ rules, then he becomes the... Why? This is one of my favorite titles for Christ in the Bible, and I think if you'd ask the average well-instructed Bible student, even well-instructed Bible teacher, to locate, sight unseen, the passage in the Bible where Christ is called the breaker, he'd have difficulty. But that's the great title that's used. If Christ rules, then he becomes the breaker. Now, why is he called the breaker? You see, this is looking forward to bondage and captivity, and then restoration from bondage and captivity. Christ becomes the breaker of bondage when he rules. He becomes the breaker of bondage. He becomes the breaker of captivity. If you want to see how wonderful it is to have Christ as the breaker, then notice the difference between the 12th verse and the 13th verse. The 12th verse describes God's people as helpless, confused sheep. That's the picture. Helpless, confused sheep. Then the 13th verse comes right back, and it describes God's people as a victorious army. Wow, what a difference there is between helpless, confused sheep and a victorious army. You see, self-rule makes us just a bunch of confused sheep. You know, one characteristic of the sheep is that they don't band together. Goats have a whole lot more sense than sheep have. When goats are in trouble, at least they band together for protection against the foe, but sheep don't. One sheep runs helplessly in one direction and another in another direction. And you see, it's just self-rule. Helpless, confused sheep. Ah, but the 13th verse has this group as a victorious army. Could there be any greater contrast? What makes the difference? The difference is self-rule changes to Christ-rule. And Christ becomes the breaker. And when Christ is the breaker, he breaks down bondage, captivity, and all the obstacles that stand in the way. What brought God's people back to Palestine from the land of Babylonian captivity? You see, this picture of Christ as the breaker is partially fulfilled in the return from Babylonian captivity. What brought them back? Here's the answer. Christ the breaker. Christ the breaker. You see, in that land of captivity, these helpless, confused sheep turned to the Lord and made him their king. And when the God of remnant in captivity turned to him and made him their king, he became the breaker, and he broke down all the obstacles. I love to compare this title for Christ as the breaker with the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. As you may know, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah describe the three great sections of the return from Babylonian captivity. The first section is in Ezra chapters 1 to 6, the return under Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple. The second return is in Ezra chapters 7 to 10, and that's the return of Ezra. Do you know how long after Zerubbabel returned to rebuild the temple that Ezra went back? It's about 80 years later. You know, you've got this book of Ezra, but Ezra's name doesn't appear in the first six chapters because Ezra wasn't even born in those first six chapters. He's writing what happened before. A period of 23 years approximately transpires in the first six chapters, and then there's a period of about 57 years between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7. So it makes 80 years between Zerubbabel's return and Ezra's return. And then in Nehemiah, chapters 1 to 13, you have Nehemiah's return, and Nehemiah comes 13 years after Ezra. You see, in other words, he comes back. It's a period of nearly 100 years over which the restoration from captivity takes place. All right, now let me ask you. Chapters 1 to 6 of Ezra, the return of Zerubbabel, early chapters. How do you get this godly remnant back? You remember about how many went back to Zerubbabel? About 50,000. That's a big group to take that long trip. Took them about 4 months to take that trip, the Bible says. How'd you get 50,000 people over all those weights? And you know, Ezra especially calls attention to that. The 8th chapter of Ezra, when Ezra returns, is often called the March of Faith. It's because Ezra said, I was ashamed to ask for a convoy of soldiers to protect us. So he said, I just trusted the Lord, and we went through that wilderness, and God kept us from all the liars and waste. What was the secret of Zerubbabel's return? The answer is the breaker. The breaker. You see, Zerubbabel and the godly remnant made Christ their king, and he broke down all those obstacles, bringing them back from bondage and captivity. What was the secret of Ezra's return? Same thing. The breaker. The breaker broke down all the obstacles. What was the secret of Nehemiah's return? Same thing. They made Christ king, and he became their breaker. Now, of course, what is true of these who return from captivity is also true of the godly remnant who remain in captivity. Who was the main one the Bible mentions, who didn't come back with them from captivity, but he was true to the Lord in captivity. That was who? Daniel. And all of those strange stories in Daniel. On the week that I just trusted the Lord, and we went through that wilderness, and God kept us from all the liars in wait. What was the secret of Zerubbabel's return? The answer is the breaker. The breaker. You see, Zerubbabel and the godly remnant made Christ their king, and he broke down all those obstacles, bringing them back from bondage and captivity. What was the secret of Ezra's return? Same thing. The breaker. The breaker broke down all the obstacles. What was the secret of Nehemiah's return? Same thing. They made Christ king, and he became their breaker. Now, of course, what is true of these who return from captivity is also true of the godly remnant who remain in captivity. Who was the main one the Bible mentions, who didn't come back with them from captivity, but he was true to the Lord in captivity. That was who? Daniel. And all of those strange stories in Daniel. On the weekend, on the Lord's Day, I'm studying a good bit in Daniel now, trying to get into that wonderful book more. And all what a thrilling thing it is. Daniel in the lion's den, Daniel's friends in the fire furnace. What was those miracles? The answer is the breaker. The breaker. Christ was king. And because he was king, he broke down all the obstacles. In order to drive this home, I like to compare Micah 2, 12 and 13 with the 12th chapter of Acts. The 12th chapter of Acts tells that thrilling story of Peter's deliverance from bondage, Peter's deliverance from jail. I like to draw in my imagination like this, and I can imagine Peter, Acts 12, along with Micah 2, 12 and 13. I can imagine Peter as he sits one night in jail. On his right side, a chain is fastened, and on his left side, a chain is fastened. And Peter is bound between two soldiers. Well, the Bible says that Herod is going to bring him out to kill him the next morning, and evidently, it's going to be a mob scene. But Peter was soundly asleep. You know, I got a great blessing from that. If you thought you were going to die tomorrow morning, could you sleep tonight? Oh, what a thrill I was. And you see, not just an ordinary death, but this was a death by fire. Herod was going to bring him out and put him to death. So Peter was asleep. And you know, he wasn't dozing fitfully. As though you just dozed off a little bit, you're so tired. Even in that. You see, he was sleeping so soundly that when the angel came to deliver him, the great light shone around about him and failed the cell, and even that light didn't awaken him from his slumber. The angel had to touch him on the side and wake him up. Peter was just sleeping in perfect peace. Now the secret of this deliverance was Christ was his king, and Christ was his breaker. And when Simon rose, those chains just dropped to his side. Then I think Peter must have thought to himself, well, so far, so good. But what about that heavy iron gate in front of us? It's too high for me to climb. It's too heavy for me to open. And the angel would say, Peter, you leave that iron gate to God. You follow me. Simon Peter walked along behind the angel. When he was 75 feet away from that iron gate, it was closed. When he was 50 feet away from that iron gate, it was closed. When he was 25 feet away from that iron gate, it was still closed. But the very second he reached it, it opened of its own accord. Who opened it? The answer is the breaker. The breaker. Christ was the breaker going before, and he broke down the obstacles supernaturally and led him on the way. Oh, young people, I just love this title for Christ. He's the breaker. And what's the condition of his being the breaker in my life? Christ is. Christ is. And you see why Micah inserts this right in the midst of these dismal passages? He's been showing the awful results of sorrow, but he shows the blessed result of Christ's rule. And the blessed result of Christ's rule is your change from helpless, bewildered sheep to a victorious army. When Christ rules rather than self-ruling the situation. Every impossible situation God permits in your life is a new opportunity for you to know Christ is the breaker. Now you see, there's where self-rule comes in. When an impossible situation comes, Satan just longs to get me to scheme in the energy of the flesh. and to devise a way out in the energy of the flesh as a substitute for God's miracle. Young people, is your heart hungry to know Christ is the breaker? You see, that's the glorious result of Christ's rule. When Christ is ruling, then he changes us from helpless, bewildered sheep to a victorious army. And I said, here I pray you, ye heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice, ye who hate the good and love the evil, who pluck off their skin from off them and their flesh from off their bones, who also eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them and break their bones and chop them in pieces as for the pot and as flesh within the cauldron. Now, as we mentioned last time, in this passage, the leaders are compared to cannibals. And I believe it's right to say that this is the most shocking figure of social injustice anywhere in the Bible. The most shocking figure of social injustice. Because it compares those who take part in social injustice with a group of cannibals. And as I told you earlier, it's not only a form of cannibalism, but it's an extreme form of cannibalism. See, not just taking the flesh, but even chopping up the bones. An ordinary cannibal don't do that. You couldn't have a stronger figure than that. Now, one thing that makes this figure so strong is that it is in connection with the leaders of a so-called Christian nation. When you talk about raw heathen being cannibals, you sort of expect that for raw heathen. But you see, Micah is comparing the leaders of a Christian nation with cannibals. That's one thing that makes it so striking, makes it so shocking. Because Israel had an open Bible. And they not only had an open Bible, it was through them that the Bible originated. And yet here's a so-called Christian nation with the leaders acting like a group of cannibals. Now, in order to grasp the full significance of this passage, I want you to compare Micah 3 with Genesis 3. Micah 3 is this picture of cannibalism in social life. Genesis 3 is man's fall into sin. And when we study Genesis 3, we emphasize the fact this is a complete fall. Basically, man could not have fallen any lower than he did. It's a complete fall. All right, when you read Genesis 3 about the complete fall, you might add, for further details, see Micah 3. Because Micah 3 shows how complete the fall is. That man falls so completely into sin that even in a Christian society, he acts like cannibals. Oh, young people, your natural heart is a cannibal heart. My natural heart is a cannibal heart. And I brought up in a Christian society where I have an awful lot of restraints that keep me from going into some of these extreme forms of cannibalism. But whenever I rule my own life, I'm just cannibal Frank Bell, I thought. And whenever you rule your own life, you are a cannibal, whatever it is. You see, cannibalism comes from self-rule. Cannibalism is the main thing wrong. Self-rule is the main thing wrong. And self-rule leads to cannibalism. On page 85, I've asked you to mention and discuss any other indications of the great wickedness of God's people, which you find in the third chapter of Micah. I want to mention three other indications of the great wickedness of God's people, which I find in this third chapter of Micah. The first indication is in chapter 3, verse 11. Chapter 3, verse 11 shows that these three great groups of leaders were involved in the social injustice. And the first is the princes. The second is the priests. And the third is the prophets. The princes were the civil leaders. And the civil leaders had turned into self-rule. The second group is the priests. The priests we would call the ecclesiastical leaders. The third is the prophets. And the prophets we would describe as the moral leaders. And all three had turned into self-rule rather than Christ-rule. Did you notice in chapter 3, verse 11, what's the main sin that's mentioned in each case? Could you tell me without looking at the Bible? Micah says the civil leaders have done what they've done for what reason? And the ecclesiastical leaders have done what they've done for the same reason. And the moral leaders have done what they've done for the same reason. What was it? Love of money. See, the same thing, he repeats it all three times. Isn't this a significant thing? Micah 3, verse 12, that follows this, is the great prophecy about the destruction of Zion. Zion's going to be plowed as a field. We told you last time how that was fulfilled. And it's not an accident that verse 11 comes just before Micah 3, 12. Because verse 11, just before Micah 3, 12, mentions the love of money. What caused the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel? What caused the destruction of the southern kingdom of Judah? Well, you say idolatry and other things. That's true. But the thing that's mentioned just before that is the love of money. And of course, love of money is a great form of idolatry. I don't bow down before sticks and stones. But I think that's one of the greatest warnings against love of money in the Bible. All right, that's the first indication of the great wickedness, that all three groups of leaders were implicated, and they did what was wrong because of their love for money. Have you ever definitely, in so many words, confessed to the Lord the sin of loving money? Have you ever definitely confessed it to the Lord in so many words? Remember, poor people need to be warned about love of money. You don't have to have a lot to love. And oftentimes, the less you have, the more you can love. One of the great things that's hurting America today is just the love of money. You watch people talk. They just talk. The whole thing is in just in terms of money. Be careful in your own planning of Christian service and anything else. And ask God to make you completely free from it. I remember Dr. Fleece made this statement once in my hearing. He said, when a Christian is seeking the will of the Lord, the idea of money shouldn't even be considered at all when you're seeking the will of the Lord. Think that through, folks. Well, you know, often your family says, after all, I've got to consider it. But because I'm in charge of my family and I'm the breadwinner of the family. I wonder if Dr. Fleece was extreme in what he said. I don't know the full working out of this, but oh, I know this. Many are turning aside from God's will in Christian work because of the whole thing of money. The second indication of the great wickedness is also found in Micah 3:11. Listen while I read Micah 3:11 in its entirety. The head thereof judge for reward, and the priest thereof teach for hire, and the prophets thereof divine for money. Yes. You know what comes after that? Paul, listen to this. Yet they lean upon Jehovah and say, is not Jehovah in the midst of us? No evil shall come upon us. And that's the last thing that's mentioned before he tells of the judgments of Jerusalem. Zion, cloud of the field. What is that? Paul, how tremendous this is. It's a false assurance of God's presence. A false assurance of God's presence. I like to call Micah 3:11 the negative version of Matthew 18:20. I think Matthew 18:20 is one of the most flippantly used verses in the Bible. You know what Matthew 18:20 says? Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. And you know how we flippantly use that, Matthew 18:20. Two or three gathered together in his name, there it is in the midst of us. But Micah 3:11 is the negative version of Matthew 18:20. And what it's saying is this: wherever you love money, the Lord is not in your midst. That's what he's saying. Wherever you love money, the Lord is not in your midst. And it's a heart-searching thing. Micah 3:11 is the negative version of Matthew 18:20. Let me read the verse again in its entirety. The head thereof judge for reward, and the priest teach for hire, the prophets divine for money, yet they lean upon Jehovah and say, is not Jehovah in the midst of us? And that's the last thing Micah mentions before he predicts the fall of Jerusalem.
It's a false assurance of God's presence. Oh, young people, ask God to deliver you completely from this in your own life, a false assurance of God's presence. And ask God to deliver those under your ministry from the false assurance of God's presence. All right, let's take our break.